Today is Wednesday, April 11th. We're going to work on urinary physiology today.
Okay, so this chapter on urinary system is going to now focus on the physiology of how the kidneys work. We know that the kidneys help us maintain blood pH, blood volume. We also maintain blood composition using the kidneys. So that's kind of what we're going to do today is figure out how the kidneys assist with that. In order to maintain quality blood, you know, blood that's got the right pH, that has the right composition, that's free of any excessive waste products, then we go through this three-step process. It's basically filtration, reabsorption, and another process different called secretion. We really haven't talked about secretion yet. You'll notice they put a tubular in front of those terms, and that's to emphasize that we're in the kidneys and that we're not somewhere else in the body. All right, so at the very top of page 106, let's focus on filtration. This process occurs in the glomerulus. So in class on Monday, at the very end, we talked a little bit about the structure of the glomerulus. Would you describe these as a set of very porous capillaries or a set of closed capillaries?
Porous.
Very porous, good. Why is it necessary for us to have porous capillaries in the kidney?
To secrete anything we don't need.
Some things can keep the small.
Good, so you may want to keep some stuff and let some stuff go. Okay, and so filtration means that we're going to try to get rid of some stuff out of the bloodstream and other things we may want to in fact keep. And how it works is like this. If you've got big items like blood cells or proteins, keep those. If you have small items like electrolytes, ions, even some waste products, filter that. Okay, the water happens to travel with the filtrate that's pushed out of those glomerular capillaries. We talked on Monday about these strange-looking octopus-shaped cells. They're called podocytes, and they're what creates these membrane slits that allows for fluids and small items to be pushed out of your capillaries. Otherwise, the big stuff like blood cells and proteins should not be filtered. They should continue traveling through the capillaries and on back to another set of arterioles. So let's talk about how we force fluids and electrolytes, even some waste products, out of our capillaries. It's based on three pressures, and actually two of these pressures we've seen before. We've talked about hydrostatic pressure in the past, and we've talked about osmotic pressure before. Which one of these pressures is based on fluids inside a vessel?
Hydrostatic.
Good. And we used to call it blood hydrostatic pressure, which is the same thing we're talking about here, but we're going to call it glomerular hydrostatic pressure because we're in the glomerulus. We just want to make sure that people know that that's our frame of reference. So does hydrostatic pressure tend to push fluids or does it tend to pull fluids?
Push.
Good. So it is created by the fluids in your bloodstream. It's the one that forces and pushes those fluids. Okay, so we'll hang on to that thought. Let's talk about osmotic pressure. Osmotic pressure is based on what in the bloodstream?
Water.
Salts and proteins, right? Okay, so the salts and proteins actually create a pull or an attraction, and they're fighting against the hydrostatic pressure that's creating a push. Which one of these two happens to be the same as blood pressure?
Hydrostatic.
Yeah, hydrostatic is actually the same as blood pressure. Good. Okay, so far we've got our old familiar story of the push and the pull. We have the push of the glomerular hydrostatic pressure. We've got the pull created by salts and proteins. That's creating our osmotic pressure. So far the story is the same. Given that story, who would be your winning pressure?
Hydrostatic,
good. So at 55 millimeters, that's got a great deal of push, and that would overcome our 30 millimeters of pull, okay? So just based on that story alone, we would end up filtering and pushing out those fluids. One complicating factor is this last pressure. We have not talked about any pressure like this before. This one is called capsular hydrostatic pressure. And because it's hydrostatic pressure, what creates it?
Fluids,
yeah. So capsular indicates where we're at. This is actually fluid that's in your Bowman's capsule out here in this space that happens to be creating a hydrostatic push. And that's going to push back into your glomerular capillaries. So you've got a push out, your glomerular hydrostatic pressure. You've got a pressure pulling fluids in, that's osmotic. And now you have a complicating factor. You've got capsule pressure actually pushing fluids back into the capillaries. So when you do the math here, you've got 55 pushing out, and you basically got 30 and 15 coming back in. So when you do the math, you've actually only got an overall push of 10 millimeters mercury, okay? So that is what we called our net filtration pressure. Right dead center of your page, you'll want to give that term a highlight. Okay, NFP here in the glomerulus is about 10 millimeters mercury. So if you happen to have low blood pressure and you're unable to effectively push and do filtration, then our whole balance here is thrown off. What might be a problem if you're not able to filter blood here in the glomerulus? Yeah, your hydrostatic pressure, you're right, would be off. And if you're not able to filter, what happens to all those waste products or things that you meant to filter? They're pulled back in, edema, yeah. Or you may not filter them at all, right? Okay, so they're stuck in your bloodstream going for a ride, and now these toxins build up in your bloodstream. So we really need to maintain the push to get these items out of your blood. So if you happen to have low pressure here, low NFP, you're gonna turn on a chemical called renin. Where is renin made? Right there in the kidneys, yeah. That little space between your afferent arteriole and your efferent arteriole.
The JGA.
JGA, good.
That's where the renin is made.
That is where the renin is made. Okay, and if you need to have renin, that means you have low blood pressure, you're probably not able to filter. Renin then travels to the liver, tells the liver to make angiotensin 1. You transform it into angiotensin 2 using an enzyme called what?
ACE.
Good, yeah. Angiotensin converting enzyme. Angiotensin 2 is a vasoconstrictor. And in fact, it will come back to your kidney and constrict that efferent arteriole. Is the efferent arteriole the path of blood leading in or leading out?
Afferent,
yeah. And then
E is out.
So it constricts the exit pathway. And if you constrict that, you actually back up blood into the glomerulus and allow for continued filtration. So it's squeezing the exit pathway that makes this an effective process. So once you get angiotensin 2, you can now produce two hormones. Where is aldosterone coming from? Adrenal glands. And where does ADH come from? Posterior pituitary, good. And which one of those claims more water back from your urine? ADH, good. And what does aldosterone reclaim?
Sodium,
good. So you've actually got a number of things here that help to maintain blood pressure. Angiotensin 2 will squeeze that exit pathway, the efferent arteriole. Then we've got aldosterone and angiotensin coming in, aldosterone and ADH coming in and helping to maintain blood pressure. So a lot of ways here to make sure that we can still filter that blood. Okay, so what is NFP? Good. And what's a normal value for it?
10.
Good. 10 millimeters mercury, and you're right, that is HG, good. And if you happen to have low NFP, what mechanism do you turn on?
Renin,
good. And the angiotensin follows, and then finally aldosterone, good. Okay, so that should take us down there under the picture on page 106 to a term called the glomerular filtration rate. GFR, that's right. So if you've got normal blood pressure and you're able to filter items out of your bloodstream, a lot of those items are discarded in your urine. So they're not meant to be kept. They're meant to be gotten rid of. If you're doing this and you have healthy functional kidneys, then you'll have a GFR that's operating about 120 to 125 milliliters of blood per minute. So that means every minute, 120 milliliters of your blood have been filtered by your kidneys. Every minute, 120 milliliters of blood will be filtered by your kidneys. That's the rate then, of course, 120 milliliters per minute. This number is actually based on your creatinine levels. If you happen to have a blood test done and they give you back your creatinine levels on the blood test, then you can calculate what your GFR is. The more creatinine you have in your bloodstream, well, what does that mean for your filtration process? Gotta work harder. Yeah, not working like it should, right? So creatinine, you may have heard of before, it's actually a byproduct of creatine phosphate metabolism. That's something we talk about when we discuss how muscles make ATP energy. And you've got about a 15-second supply that's a booster of creatine phosphate. So creatinine then is the waste product from that metabolic transformation. If you're young, 120 is your number. With every decade of life, you're going to probably peel about 10 off that number. So you can imagine somebody in his or her 70s or 80s, they don't expect to have a GFR around 120. It'd be amazing, yeah. They may have a kidney transplant if that's their number, right? If you're in your 80s, your normal levels are somewhere around 60. So they can drop that low, you know, and that's normal for somebody who's that age. So we don't expect 120 throughout your entire lifetime. We tend to expect that number to fall about by 10, approximately every decade of life. So once we fall into this below 60 range, we start looking at kidney disease. And the lower we get here, the more likely we are to end up in kidney failure. They say below 15 milliliters filtered per minute is actually, you know, you're not getting enough filtration to take place. So those waste products stay in your bloodstream, the fluids stay in your bloodstream, and if you keep all those fluids, you end up with edema and swelling. So kidney failure means that the kidneys just aren't filtering and they're not able to take those waste products out.
That's when you would not need a transplant, would
it? They'll do dialysis, and then yeah, they could do a transplant if that's, you know, the next step.
If that's your last kidney,
that's right. So you can see numbers here, you know, stage one, normal function, 90 or higher. So 120 is really awesome if you're operating at that level, but you know, you can continue to drop down to the point where you're just not able to get rid of those waste products. Because the kidneys are performing acid-base balance, because they're maintaining ion levels, water content in your bloodstream, this becomes a big deal for us when we can't get rid of all those waste products, excess water, excess ions that we would expect to be, you know, lost in the urine. Okay, so just want to make a note here. You'll want to highlight that number too. An ideal normal number for GFR is around 120 milliliters per minute. And then if we suspect kidney problems, we can run a renal clearance test. That clearance test allows us to determine what's going on and how effective those kidneys are at filtering. So the clearance test may be done with something like inulin. It's a polysaccharide, and it allows us to know if we inject this much into the bloodstream, we should have only so much left after a period of time. So that tells us that the kidneys are either filtering as they should be or that they're not. Okay, so let's just repeat this page. Got a couple of things to point out. Normal NFP for the glomerulus is what? 10 milliliters or millimeters mercury, right, good. And when you push items out of the bloodstream, we call that filtrate. What is okay to be included in the filtrate that you push out of these capillaries?
Waste.
Water, waste. How about glucose? Yeah, filter it. How about amino acids? Yeah, filter. Filter them. Actually, they're okay because they're tiny and we can get them back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if they're big, then we got a problem, right? So, yeah, tiny things like amino acids, monosaccharides like glucose, electrolytes like sodium and potassium or other things, you know, we can filter small items. How about water? Do we filter that? Yep, filter that. Good. How about blood cells?
No.
Too big, right? Okay. How about blood proteins?
Too big.
Good. So whatever you're capable of squeezing out across the wall of these capillaries is going to be small. It's going to be able to fit through these podocytes. And, of course, it's captured by this Bowman's capsule. So not big stuff, not blood cells, not proteins, smaller stuff like liquid water, electrolytes, glucose, waste products, amino acids, all that, going to filter it all out.
What could cause the gallbladder to be secreting out large things like red blood cells and all like that?
If you've got an inflammation there, like say a bacterial infection, then those membrane slits kind of open up, and then now you've got blood cells or even proteins that could escape. So there's a condition called glomerulonephritis, basically glomerular infection. That is one reason that we might see blood in the urine, for instance. People who are burn patients also can have proteins lost through these filtration membranes.
That's why you would see hemoglobin in the urine.
Well, albumin or things like that you might see in a burn patient too. Yeah, leaving. Yeah. How about questions on this page? Feel pretty good here? Okay, so numbers to know, NFP is 10 millimeters mercury. The GFR, 120 milliliters per minute. And if you had to describe it, you would say it's the amount of blood filtered by the kidney in a
minute.
Yeah. So normally we don't do it that fast. We can do it over the period of an hour or 6 hours if needed. Looks like we're ready to move on to page 107. Okay, so I've got a cheat sheet over here on the board. We're just going to keep track of some terms. We just talked about the word filtration or to filter items. So we take items out of the blood and we put them into the renal tubule, okay? So not the big stuff, not the blood cells, not the proteins, but the stuff that can fit through the membrane slits, those are the items that we're gonna filter. So we're gonna move items, okay, from the blood into the renal tubule. And the word for this stuff, collectively, it's called filtrate. Okay, so we're gonna call this stuff filtrate. I'm out of board space today. Okay, so those items that you move from the bloodstream into the renal tubule, that stuff is called the filtrate. And it's pretty much whatever's in your blood plasma, except for the big stuff. No blood cells, no blood proteins. Okay, so in case you can't read the board, it says filtered items. Well, we're going to move items from the bloodstream to the renal tubule and call this stuff that you're moving out of the bloodstream, call it filtrate.
And there's no blood cells in what?
No blood cells, no blood proteins. They're too big. I know most of you carry book bags. By the end of the semester, do you have all sorts of junk in your book bag? And at the end of the term, it kind of feels good to just take it and dump it and say, all right, let's clean this thing out. I'm gonna make a fresh start the next term. So you dump your book bag and you sort through it and you throw away gum wrappers and this pencil doesn't work, toss that. And these notes are pretty good. I might hold on to these for another semester. So you keep certain items and you toss certain items. So that's what we're doing here. We've taken items out of the bloodstream, we called it filtrate, and now we're gonna sit here and say, I wanna keep this, I wanna toss that. And items that you want to keep are gonna be reabsorbed. So if you want to keep them, what we mean is you want to move the items from the filtrate back into the bloodstream. So somewhere along the renal tubule, you're gonna get picked up, you're gonna be moved back into the bloodstream, and you're kept, okay? So reabsorption means we're gonna move items. From that tubule, okay, move those items from that tubule back to the blood. And just to be specific, where we're putting it is we're putting these wanted items back in the bloodstream at the peritubular capillary. What you keep, you're going to move back into the peritubules.
Back to that?
Okay. Yeah. So let's take your book bag. You just took everything out of your book bag. You dumped all your contents. You gather all the functional pens and pencils, and you want to keep those, so you put them back in your book bag. What happens here in the kidney? You've done the very same thing. You've dumped all this stuff out of your bloodstream except for the big items like the proteins and the blood cells. And then you say, hey, you know, I want to keep this water. I want to keep this sodium. Let's keep the glucose. So we simply move it from this renal tubule, which is, you know, PCT, loop of Henle, DCT, and we put those items back into the peritubular capillaries. What this means to me is, hey, if you're putting it back in the bloodstream, you obviously want to keep these items. So tubular reabsorption implies I want this, I'm going to return it back to the bloodstream. So the items just got a quick trip into the nephron and then right back into the blood flow. So let's talk about some things that were filtered that are now going to be reabsorbed. What we're doing here is called PCT reabsorption. And what that means is the items were filtered at the glomerulus. They got captured by the Bowman's capsule. They made a very short trip next door to your PCT. And then your body says, hey, I want that. Come on back into the bloodstream. So these items are moved right back into your peritubular capillaries. Why might you want to keep a lot of your sodium? That could be a reason, right, for hydration, right? Okay, thinking back to Bio-210, what does sodium do during muscles and nerves?
It allows you to contract.
Contractions, nerve impulse transmission. So you might want some of that sodium back that you just filtered. So in fact, around 60 to 70% of it gets reabsorbed back into the peritubular capillaries. Sodium's kind of like a ringleader. When you reabsorb sodium, you take other items with it. In fact, you take glucose, chlorine, bicarbonate, and if you know you need water, that comes too. So basically, if you take sodium, you've got a whole bunch of other stuff that comes along with it. Yeah, well, because it's a balance, the positive cation for the negative anion. So this reabsorption that we're doing here is called obligatory reabsorption. And that means you're gonna take this stuff whether or not you need it.
It's called what?
It's called obligatory, yeah. And it's probably written down there, yeah, with water on 107. So, sodium is the ringleader. Sodium is reabsorbed and it takes with it a whole bunch of stuff. Glucose comes too. chlorine, bicarbonate, and water. All of them travel together like a pack back into your peritubular capillaries.
Well, we need to know this whole chart for the exam.
A couple of key things we'll look at on there. I'm getting ready to talk about transport max. You'll need to know that it's all obligatory water reabsorption so far. Nothing for sodium and nothing for amino acids, but we'll talk through those other things. So let's talk about glucose for just a moment. If you happen to have blood glucose levels above 180 milligrams per deciliter, you will only reabsorb up to 180 and take that back into your bloodstream. So let me give you an example. If you've had, you know, a meal of Krispy Kreme donuts and you have high blood sugar, then your high blood sugar is going to be filtered by the kidneys. It's small, glucose gets pushed out into the filtrate. Now, if you had a blood sugar level of 350, you're only going to reabsorb 180 units of blood glucose back into your bloodstream. So what happens to the rest of that glucose?
Lost in urine.
Lost in urine, yeah. So in that case, we have a condition called glycosuria. And that indicates that either we had a really sweet meal recently or we've got diabetes mellitus. So the only amount that you can take back is 180 units of glucose. That's because we have 180 channels for it and not any more. So if anything higher than that, we're not going to reabsorb the glucose back into the bloodstream.
180
milligrams. Yeah, 180. You can take back 180 milligrams, and that's all we've got room for. So you can think of them as channels for those sodium or glucose. From the top. Blood comes into your kidney, travels along a renal artery, a segmental artery. What's next?
Interlobar.
And then we've got an arcuate artery.
Cortical
radiate. And then finally get afferent. Good. When you get to the glomerulus, what happens to blood plasma, electrolytes?
They all get secreted and squeezed out.
Squeeze them out. We call that filtration. Okay, and what you capture here in this Bowman's capsule is no longer called blood plasma. Let's now call it
urine.
Not yet. It's going to be urine eventually. Filtrate. Yeah. So we're going to do filtration there at that glomerulus. What we make here is called filtrate. That stuff used to be blood plasma. We just moved it out. We pushed it out into those Bowman capsules. And the Bowman capsule is hooked up to this PCT. So here comes the filtrate traveling down the PCT. All right, so let's talk about some things that you're going to reabsorb back into the bloodstream, whether or not you want them. They're obligatory reabsorption. What is one thing that you reabsorb?
Sodium and water.
Sodium and water. Good. What else?
Glucose.
Everything else.
And then chlorine.
Chlorine.
Bicarbonate.
Bicarbonate. And amino acids are weird. They say, you guys go do what you want. I do my own thing. And they don't go back with the group. In fact, they are reabsorbed by themselves. So, you know, you've got this cluster that goes back as a unit. You know, they're all hanging out together, but amino acids are not. So I kind of put them out here separate. So when we say that we're going to reabsorb these items, let's take them on a trip. Let's take a sodium ion. If you bring it through a renal artery, segmental artery, interlobar artery, what's next?
Arcuate
artery, what's next? Cortical radiate, then you hit the afferent arteriole. If I want to filter it, what happens at the glomerulus?
Filtration.
What's my next step? Filter it out into the capsule, let the capsule capture it, and then where do I go next with this filtrate?
PCT.
So that's how sodium got here. Sodium came in through the bloodstream, got filtered by your glomerulus. It's now in your PCT, and your body says, oh, hey, let's keep that sodium, move it back into your peritubular capillaries. All right, so you move it into the peritubular capillaries. Sometimes it's diffusion, facilitated diffusion, active transport, whatever it is. Then we end up in the peritubular capillaries going for a ride. We link up with the venule, cortical radiate vein, and then where next?
Back into the
arcuate vein, interlobar vein, and renal vein. Good. So these items that you just kept took a real quick detour through the nephron, and then they're right on back into that blood flow. So we keep most of our sodium. Glucose follows, but only how much?
180.
Good. So 180 units you can reabsorb. I did want to mention there's another term on your sheet associated with glucose. You'll notice it says osmotic diuretic. Okay, you see that term?
Where?
Oh, do I have it on that page? Let me flip. If you flip the page, I've actually got it there on the next page, but we can talk about it here too. Let me put that term up here for you. Okay, so when we're talking about glucose, I should mention to you that it can be a diuretic. What do diuretics make you do?
Lose water.
So if you've got glucose present in your nephron tube, meaning if you didn't reabsorb all of it, then glucose can actually pull water and keep it in that nephron tube. Together, both glucose and that water will end up leaving your body as urine.
Say that one more time, please.
Sure. If you have, let's take an example. Let's say that you have a dozen donuts. Let's say that you have a blood sugar of 1,000, okay? You can only reabsorb 180 units back into your bloodstream, and the other remaining units of glucose are sitting here in your PCT. Well, glucose is like salt. You know, water follows salt, but water also follows glucose. So the water present here in the PCT has two choices. Either it can hang out with glucose, which is really fun, or it can come back into the bloodstream where only 180 units came. So guess where water stays? PCT. Yeah, it's really fun there with all that sugar. So both sugar and water travel the PCT to the loop, to the DCT. Comes out as urine. Yeah. So diuretic means it makes you lose water, okay, so it makes you pee. And the word osmotic means, well, water tends to follow salt, but hey, now it also follows the sugar. So if you've had a really sugary meal and you urinate frequently afterwards, that's what's happening. You're losing sugar and the water chooses to stay and follow that more concentrated sugar.
Isn't that one of our pathways?
That may in fact be. Let's see.
If so, I'm going to have to think something.
bicarb. Yeah, we can do bicarb. We'll do that one too in just a moment. That's our number three, it looks like.
So it's trace the pathway of creatinine that is secreted, start with renal artery, and it has creatinine and leave in the body and urine. That's kind of similar, right?
Totally different, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we haven't done secretion yet.
Okay.
Oh,
no.
Okay, so let's take these items here. We've got sodium, water follows it. Glucose, only up to 180 units, will be returned to the bloodstream along with sodium. Chlorine and sodium hang out together, so chlorine is reabsorbed. Chlorine actually helps us make hydrochloric acid for our stomachs. Bicarbonate ions can also be made and reabsorbed by the kidney. So what is the relationship between bicarbonate and blood pH?
That's carbon dioxide. That's what carbon dioxide turns into when it remains in the blood.
That's right. That's how carbon dioxide is transported, right? Okay. So, in fact, carbon dioxide can make bicarbonate ions and hydrogens. And those hydrogens happen to be what acidifies our bloodstream. The bicarbonates, though, actually behave as a base. So if you reabsorb more bicarbs back in your bloodstream, it is like adding an alkaline base back to your bloodstream. So I'm going to make a note here. This one is a base. Let me repeat that. If you add bicarbonate back to your bloodstream by reabsorbing more of it, what happens to your blood pH?
Alkaline,
right. Does that mean your blood pH goes up or down?
Up.
Goes up. So what might be the problem with the blood pH if you need to reabsorb more base back into the bloodstream?
It might be because of acidosis.
Yeah, you got acidosis, it's too acidic. So we might have respiratory acidosis, and we compensate by doing this, by taking more bicarbs back into the bloodstream. Going to put a note here. We reabsorb more bicarbs when the blood pH is too acidic. This is part of that acid-base balance. This is how we're going to fix blood pH problems. All right, so amino acids may also be reabsorbed, but they do not hang out with the other group. They are reabsorbed separately from sodium and its gang, so it's not going to be coupled with that reabsorption process. Okay, let's take number three. That's the tracing on the bottom of page 105. That tracing says we're going to filter and reabsorb bicarbonate. The directions say to start with the renal artery, filter it, and then reabsorb traveling back to the renal vein. So I know two things. I know my starting point is renal artery. I know my ending point is the renal vein. So I can use part of what's on page 105 to help me, but I have to take a detour through filtration and reabsorption. So start at the top of page 105. Let's work as far as we can. When you take bicarbonate to the kidney, it travels from the renal artery to the segmental artery, interlobar, arcuate, cortical radiate, afferent arteriole, and then what happens to it at the glomerulus?
Filter it,
right. So you may want to just put a little note there at the glomerulus. You're going to flip the page with me. Take it from the glomerulus to page 107. Do you see the third bullet point from the top? Okay, so all you need to do is go from glomerulus, now you're at the PCT, peritubular capillaries, venule, cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, interlobar, and renal. Okay, so just let me repeat, on page 105, if you're doing bicarbonate that's been filtered and reabsorbed, you travel from the renal artery to the glomerulus.
This is number three.
That's number three. You travel renal artery to the glomerulus step by step. And then flip on over to page 107, and there's the second half of your pathway. PCT, peritubular capillaries, so forth. Thank you. so just to repeat, number three, bicarbonate that's been filtered and reabsorbed. You travel from the renal artery to the glomerulus on page 105. We then flip to page 107. Third bullet point says from the PCT, peritubular capillaries, take it all the way to the renal vein. So in fact, any of these items that we just did, sodium, water, glucose, bicarb, amino acids, they all have the same exact flow pathway.
For the choice number two, which page was that one?
Which one?
For number two.
It's secretion.
Yeah, we're not there yet. We'll get there though. Okay, but we could do number four, so let's hit that one. So sodium, it says, is filtered and not reabsorbed. I've got two things I'm gonna need to look at. I've got start with the renal artery. Okay, I know where to begin, and end with urine. So I got two pieces of info to work with. If I start with the renal artery, what page should I be on to get that tracing? 105. Okay, and because it's being filtered, at what point do I need to stop that page and flip? Glomerulus, yeah. Okay, so if you take it from renal artery, segmental artery, interlobar artery, arcuate, cortical radiate, afferent, that's right, and then your glomerulus. Okay. Then go with me to page 104. You can actually use the picture. The glomerulus sends us into the PCT. So about halfway down the page. And then looks like loop of Henle. DCT is next. And we end up in the collecting duct. So from the glomerulus, we're filtered. We travel PCT, loop of Henle, DCT, that's it, collecting duct. And actually, flip back one more page with me. Bottom of page 103, that's the last part of the tracing. Okay, from the collecting duct, hit the renal papilla, and there you go. Minor calyx, major calyx, pelvis, end up in the urethra.
So renal from the collecting duct, it goes to the renal papilla, is that what you said?
That's right, yeah.
And the renal pelvis and then the minor and major, right?
Yeah, take it all the way out.
Okay. Oh, it's at the bottom.
So let's do sodium one more time. Sodium is filtered. That means it comes in by way of the bloodstream. It travels through renal artery, segmental, interlobar, arcuate, cortical radiate artery, afferent arteriole, glomerulus, good. Now you're out in the renal tubule, you travel through PCT, loop of Henle, DCT, collecting duct, and then you're back to 103. You're going now out through the renal papilla, minor calyx, major calyx, renal pelvis, ureter, urinary bladder, and your urethra. That's it. Hey, we got only one left to do, so we're doing pretty good. This may seem obvious to say, but if you're going to be reabsorbed, the item had to be filtered in the first place. You know, if items are not filtered, then you can't really reabsorb them. When we talk about reabsorbing items, we have to assume that they're somewhere along this renal tubule and that we're moving them back in the bloodstream. The only way you can get in the renal tubule is if it was filtered back here at the glomerulus. Okay? So if items are never filtered, then you can't reabsorb them. It's got to work that you filter them in order to reabsorb them later on. Let me move you to the bottom of that page. We're back on 107. We were in the PCT. We did a lot of obligatory reabsorption there. That means we took those items back whether or not we needed them. And we're now going to move along to the loop of Henle or nephron loop. So at this point, you'll notice a term called countercurrent multiplication. That occurs only here in this loop. So what electrolyte do you think is a big player in maintaining your hydration status?
Sodium.
Sodium, good, that is right. And what always loves to follow sodium?
Water.
Water. And that balance has to be right to maintain your body's functions like muscles and nerves and your hydration. So we now have an opportunity here at this loop to adjust how salty your bloodstream is going to be. And the process of adjustment is called countercurrent multiplication. Countercurrent means flowing in opposite directions, and this is where we actually say, okay, we didn't take in enough sodium back here in the PCT, let's take in some more. Or, you know, we've got too much water in the bloodstream, let's not take in quite as much. So here at this loop of Henle, our body says, let's make sure the saltiness of your bloodstream is just right. Therefore, when you travel down the descending limb of the loop of Henle, your body only reclaims water. Not salt, just water. Just water. Yeah. Sure. Okay, so the whole goal here is to make sure your blood has the right saltiness. And since we reabsorb both salt and water together back here in the PCT, then we may have upset the balance of saltiness in our bloodstream. So we now have an opportunity to adjust how salty or how not salty your blood needs to be. And we do water and salt separately in this loop of Henle. As you travel down the descending limb, we only reabsorb water. And as you travel up the ascending limb, you only reabsorb salt, that's right. And by salt, what I mean is sodium and its big buddy, chlorine. So why not absorb them together here at this loop? What if you were reabsorbing salt? What would water automatically do? It follows the salt, right? You may absorb too much water. You may absorb not enough. Maybe you need salt. Maybe you don't need water, vice versa. So we separate them when we say, okay, you know, we're going to take you one at a time. And this way we can make sure that we're getting the blood saltiness just right. I have a hard time keeping this straight, but I've got a trick for you. Waterfalls, right? Waterfalls down a waterfall. Waterfalls on the downside. Then, of course, I know that salt is on the upside. So waterfalls down.
Water's going down, water's going to come up salt.
That's right. Water's coming on the downside. Salt's on the upside. So you may have heard of loop diuretics. There's actually a lot of different forms of diuretics, but loop diuretics actually work on, guess what, the nephron loop. So if you take a loop diuretic that inhibits sodium reabsorption, you're working on the upside, that ascending limb, and you prevent sodium from being reabsorbed. So, you know, each type of diuretic may inhibit a certain type of reabsorption. Lasix is one that actually prevents that salt from being reabsorbed on the ascending limb back up. So now we're ready to talk about DCT reabsorption. That's on page 108. So we've actually taken a lot of stuff back in the bloodstream. We've taken all those items in the PCT. We just adjusted how salty our bloodstream is here. And at the DCT, we now say, okay, do we really need anything else? And the body will tell us if it needs for us to reabsorb anything further by using a hormone. So when we think about aldosterone and ADH, we've often talked about their roles in helping us reabsorb certain items. Where they play their role is here in the DCT. If you have aldosterone present in the DCT, what specifically do you reabsorb?
Sodium.
Sodium, yep, salt, good. So if you need more sodium to raise your blood pressure, then aldosterone will present here at the DCT. It inserts sodium channels and allows you to reclaim more sodium back into the bloodstream. And of course, who's the big tag team buddy for aldosterone?
ADH.
And it tells your kidneys to keep more water. So ADH will also come along, insert aquaporins or water channels, and we reabsorb more water back into the bloodstream. So those two kind of act as a tag team to increase blood pressure. Okay, so if your blood pressure is normal, do you need aldosterone and ADH here?
Mm-hmm.
No. Nope. Right. So if blood pressure looks good, if your salty level looks good, you will not have ADH and aldosterone present.
All these things increase high blood pressure. It's amazing how everybody doesn't have high blood pressure.
Really, because everything is about increasing it. Only one thing is about decreasing it. If you've got these two hormones sitting here and you keep more sodium and more water, that moves into the peritubular capillaries, to the venule, to the cortical radiate vein, and then we're back to arcuate vein, interlobar vein, renal vein, so that stuff is back in the blood flow. What this does mean that you're not going to have so much stuff leaving in the urine, and if aldosterone and ADH are present, what color is the urine? Dark yellow, right? Concentrated. Because where's all that fluid going?
It's going out.
Back in your...
Back in your blood flow.
Yeah. So if you've got ADH and aldosterone present, you're keeping the water that would have ended up in your urine. That means your urine's going to be a dark yellow color, but the good news is your blood pressure will be increased. Let's see. Another hormone that may be sitting here is PTH. I know this takes you way back down endocrine system. What does that one help us reclaim?
Calcium.
Good. Some kidney stones are calcium based. If you've got a PTH problem, that might be the issue for calcium and excess, you know, kidney stone formation. So they got to look at all those things if they're seeing, you know, recurring events of kidney stones, since a lot of them are in fact calcium based, and that could come from a case of hyperparathyroidism.
So, kidney stones are just made from calcium.
Some of them are. Some of them are oxalate, which is a different product. It depends what, you know, what's going on with your body, which one you may make. Hopefully neither one we make, right? Okay, so on your sheet there, let me hit the far right column of page 108. So, you know, if you drink caffeinated drinks, oftentimes they make you urinate, and they are diuretics because the caffeine works against the absorption here. You'll notice that caffeine works against sodium reabsorption, which is aldosterone's job. Caffeine also works against water reabsorption, which is ADH's job here. And then, you know, alcohol also can play a role, and glucose can play a role in water reabsorption. So it's not just, you know, we keep what we want. Depending on what's in our system, we may in fact impair that reabsorptive process. Okay, so what we've covered so far are three types of reabsorption. Reabsorption in the PCT, we take it whether or not we need it. Why might we reabsorb items in the nephron loop? What are we trying to do? Good, balance out salt and water, do them separately, okay? And the only reason we reabsorb in the DCT?
Blood pressure,
yeah, or calcium, right? So you may not need these hormones here at all. You may be perfectly fine and not need these sitting here, but we have them in case we need to reabsorb more items. Because if you don't get them here, what's the next step on our journey?
Right on out.
Yeah, so the next step is hit the collecting duct, travel to the urine, and no more opportunities to reclaim those items.
Basically the last game before you leave.
Yeah, basically, last chance. Okay, so let me take you over to page 109, and this will be tubular secretion. Cheat sheet, let him jot down a note that says secretion is to move items from the blood to the urine. Okay, so secretion means items are moved from the blood to the urine. Secretion is opposite to reabsorption. Reabsorbed items, you put them in the bloodstream. Secreted items, that's garbage. You gotta get rid of it. That dumps into the urine. Okay, so secretion is opposite to reabsorption. Secretion moves items directly from the blood to the urine. We don't want these items that are being secreted. We want to get rid of them. So there's a few items here that we're going to talk about. Let's talk about potassium first on page 109. You know, potassium can come from the renal artery, segmental, interlobar, arcuate, all the way up here to the glomerulus. That potassium may not be filtered, so it continues on a trip through the efferent arteriole, and then here it goes traveling through these peritubular capillaries. You know, it thinks it's safe, and then lo and behold, those peritubular capillaries pass by your DCT, and there sits aldosterone. So what does aldosterone do when you reabsorb sodium? Dump the potassium, right? So by dumping it, we're exchanging it, in other words, for sodium. If you keep sodiums, you end up exchanging that for some potassiums. You remember that old sodium-potassium pump? Does a 3-for-2 exchange? That's what aldosterone can turn on, is a pump that actually makes you keep 3 sodiums and secrete 2 potassiums. So up here, I'm going to write secretion. so up there next to potassium, I also put a H plus for hydrogen ions. Aldosterone, if present, will also make you secrete hydrogens into your urine. So what's wrong with blood pH if you're secreting hydrogens?
Too acidic,
right? Too low. So you get rid of those extra hydrogens by basically moving them from your bloodstream to your urine. They are gone. Too acidic. So we just did acid base. When you're thinking about respiratory problems, you know, if you've got respiratory acidosis or respiratory alkalosis, the compensation is always the metabolic system. And the metabolic system involves the kidneys. So if your problem is respiratory acidosis, your general compensation is metabolic alkalosis, right? And if your problem is respiratory alkalosis, your general compensation is metabolic acidosis, right? So let me make a point here. If you need to adjust your blood pH, you can do two things. You can either reabsorb more bicarbs or you can reabsorb less bicarbs. That's all you can do. You can reabsorb more or less of them. And along with that, you can secrete more hydrogens or you can secrete less hydrogens. You know, so we're not deciding whether or not to reabsorb or secrete bicarbs. The only thing we can do to bicarbs is either increase or decrease their reabsorption. And the only thing we can do with hydrogens, increase or decrease their secretion. And the good news is, if you can figure out what you're doing, if you know, if you say, hey, I'm too acidic, I need more base, I'm going to increase bicarb reabsorption, then you're automatically going to increase hydrogen ion secretion. So if you can figure out which one, you know, is the fix, those arrows go in the same direction. So let me give you an example. If you've got an emphysema patient in respiratory acidosis, that's my problem, respiratory acidosis. I need to get rid of hydrogens, right? Okay, and I need to make my blood more basic. So what should I do to my bicarbs? Add more, increase my bicarbs. Increase hydrogen secretion, right. So if I'm increasing bicarb reabsorption, I am automatically gonna increase increase hydrogen secretion. What's that?
Those go hand in hand then.
Those go hand in hand, right. And I'm not sure if you're catching the pattern here, but if I'm in acidosis, my blood pH is down, I'm going to fix it by increasing reabsorption and secretion, so my fix is in opposite direction. So if you know your problem's acidosis, you know your solution is to increase reabsorption of bicarb and increase secretion of hydrogens. Okay. And likewise, if I'm in alkalosis, that means my blood pH is too high. My solution is to decrease. Bingo, that's it. Okay, so if I'm in alkalosis, decrease bicarb reabsorption, decrease hydrogen ion secretion. Other things that you may secrete are waste products of metabolism. You'll notice on your worksheet that urea, uric acid, creatinine, all can be secreted here. Urea is a breakdown product. It's a waste of protein metabolism. So when you hydrolyze or break apart a protein, urea is a waste product that you'll end up secreting into the urine. No surprise, right? Because the name urine sounds like urea. Likewise, uric acid is also a product that must be secreted. That means that you don't filter it. That means that you get it over here to the DCT and you say, oh, hey, that's garbage. Get it out of the urine, you know, put it into the urine, get rid of this stuff. It is a breakdown from RNA metabolism. And creatinine is a waste product from muscle metabolism, you know, that booster that we get for 15 seconds during exercise. If you read the very bottom part of that chart with me, it says creatinine can be both filtered and secreted, but it's typically not reabsorbed. So it's a little messy for using for GFR because it can be secreted, but nonetheless, the goal is to get it out of your body, dump it into the urine, and get rid of it.
What did you say? Will you repeat that one more time?
Sure. The creatinine part?
Yes.
Okay, so it can be both filtered and secreted, which means either way, the goal is to get it in the urine. And notice it's not reabsorbed, yeah. So what I've left for you is a chart on page 110 to practice with. There is an answer to that on the D2L announcements. We already played with page 111, and I'm going to let you guys read 112 through 114. I think it's a pretty easy read. That's 112 through 114. A lot of that stuff is going to double dip your lab content. Where we're heading in here on Monday is fluid electrolyte. So if you do need to hear any of today's content, again, let me know. We can go back and review this if you need to.